The Guardian.
I'm standing outside the British Library, a palace of red brick beside London's King's Cross Station, where academics, writers, students and day trippers come to pore over some of the most precious manuscripts and books in the world. From the oldest printed book to the first atlas of Europe, from Vesalius's stunning 16th century anatomy drawings to the priceless Lindisfarne Gospels, these are primary sources to be handled not with kid gloves but surgical ones. I'm here with Anne Perkins, political journalist and biographer. And Anne, it was from source material perhaps not quite as old but just as raw as this that you put together your authorised biography of the iconic Labour politician Barbara Castle, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes.
Now, you obviously had her full cooperation and permission to ask questions of anyone you liked. So what could possibly go wrong?
The answer is that you can somehow not see the truth even when it's there in front of you in the documents and in the context surrounding the documents.
That all comes down to human memory, doesn't it, of your subject as much as anything
else? It's their memory and the way they use their memory and the way they misremember things that all becomes terribly important.
So we decided to devote this week's podcast to exploring these challenges of reconstructing the past and negotiating the fallibility of just such human memories. Because, Anne, however deeply you research your subject, you can't always be sure that they're actually giving you a true reconstruction of events, can you?
I think the subject's memories themselves are extraordinarily unreliable. And I think the older they get, and particularly when they've done a lot of writing themselves, the more their memory kind of shrinks to the version they've created, and the harder it is to get them to think afresh or to speculate about events in which they've been involved. And you can see this, in fact, in the way Barbara Castle organised her papers, for example.
Well, let's go and have a look at some of those papers. Now, we found a niche in the library away from all the buzz of the foyer. And Anne, let's just talk a little bit about who Barbara Castle was and what her importance is. A lot of listeners will only know her from her cameo in Made in Dagenham, the recent film about the striking Ford machinists, won't they?
Yeah, which actually was a great sort of moment in her political history. Barbara Castle was a woman whose political career, whose life spanned the 20th century. She was a pioneering woman member of parliament. These papers date from the 1950s, at which point she had been an MP for about 10 years. She was part of the great 1945 Labour landslide. She was always on the radical wing of the party. She was also always on the romantic wing of the party.
Fiery red hair as well.
Fiery red hair, incredibly attractive, fantastic charisma, never allowed a hint of fear to cross her face, and dead cheeky with it. And she became this kind of sort of, icon's too strong a word, she was almost the sort of pet of the House of Commons, but at the same time rather a challenging pet, you know, like one of those little sort of pugs that might turn and savage your ankles at any minute.
So how deeply immersed did you get in her life?
I got very involved in her political life. I was a political journalist. I kind of thought politically. I saw her as a political character, and that was the story I wanted to tell. And I was absorbed and fascinated by the tale of the split, the arguments between left and right in the Labour Party through that period, really from the 30s to the 60s.
She gave you access to all her papers,
did she? She gave me access to all her papers.
And they were in her house, all these papers.
And they were
all
in this house that was so important to her, Hell Corner it was called, little cottage, little old farmhouse.
Did she let you take her papers away to study them?
She was immensely protective of her papers. I had to go there each day and sit in a rather cold kind of sort of stable or some kind of sort of outhouse, and she had just had boxes and boxes and boxes of these files, most of them very kind of well organized, but some of them kind of gorgeously full of these handwritten love letters between herself and this older man with whom she had an affair from the early 1930s until he died in 1942, I think.
So this took up 2 years of your life, basically.
It took up 2 years, nearly 3 years of my life, and could and probably should have taken much longer. I didn't realise then that publishers' deadlines were a starting point for negotiation rather than...
Oh, you were a very good person who always met your copy deadlines.
I'm a journalist, I meet my copy deadlines.
Now, it must have come as a real shock when you found papers that cast a completely different view on certain big incidents.
Well, the truth is that I was asked to do a talk by the Bodleian, which is where Barbara's papers are, and they asked me to pull out one particular document to talk about. So I went back immediately to one little group of papers because I thought they were the most visual. It didn't occur to me when I went back to them that I would have the mortifying experience of realising I'd really not understood them at the time. It wasn't that there were new papers, it was just that I had not properly thought about them and understood them and explored them.
Should we have a look at them? You've got them here, haven't you? Oh my goodness, there's a photocopies of tobacco packets, Capstan Navy Cut cigarettes.
They are the most wonderfully evocative group of papers. They are ripped up cigarette packets from the mid-1950s. It's a dinner. It's not just the cigarette packets, which she's ripped up and covered in shorthand.
It's all got her writing, shorthand.
She's covered it in shorthand notes.
What sort of a woman rips up a cigarette packet and then keeps it for posterity?
Well, it's an indication of how immensely significant this dinner was.
So tell us about this dinner.
Well, it was the dinner that the Labour Party, or the Labour's National Executive, its governing body, held in order to entertain Khrushchev and Bulganin, who were the new Soviet leaders in this period, which is 1956, and they were paying the first post-revolution visit to London. The Stalin era has ended. He had died in 1953. A month or two before Khrushchev came, Khrushchev, at a closed meeting of the Communist Party, had denounced Stalin as a tyrant. It looked to the West, and indeed to many people in the Soviet bloc, as if the climate might be about to change. In fact, the New Statesman announced in hyperbolic tone just before he arrived, Khrushchev is coming to wind up the Cold War. So you can imagine with what excitement this dinner, this moment to encounter face to face these men who might deliver Europe from this a terrifying standoff, nuclear armed now standoff.
Huge excitement, but what actually happened?
Well, it was supposed to be an informal, off-the-record, secret dinner. And what happened was that a right-wing MP, who later became Foreign Secretary, George Brown, hated the Soviets, hated everything to do with them, and particularly felt that they were trampling over social democracy in Eastern Europe and within the Soviet Union. And he positioned himself opposite Khrushchev, and he barracked him. He started winding Khrushchev up. And when Khrushchev suggested that the Nazi-Soviet pact, a deeply contentious moment when the Soviets backed Hitler against the Allies in 1939, had been the Allies' fault, George Brown absolutely exploded and challenged Khrushchev on this, whereupon Khrushchev went off on a great rant about how terrible the Allies were. But that was only part one of the evening. Part two of the evening was when Gaitskell, who had not incidentally attended to speak, decided he must stand up and make his case in defence of imprisoned social democrats and trade unionists. And that would absolutely tip the balance as far as Khrushchev was concerned. He denounced social democrats as the enemies of the working class, which you can imagine didn't go down at all well among the Labour Party. And then at that point, left and right piled in together to attack Khrushchev and demand that he respected pluralism and denounce the totalitarian nature of communism.
So what was Barbara Castle's role in this?
Well, she was there as a member of the National Executive. I think she just felt she was at a fantastically important event. At least that's how she would have us believe she felt, because in her autobiography, she describes realising that she was at this fantastically important event and scribbling these notes frantically, and then rushing round to the New Statesman with them so that they can write a leader based on what had actually happened.
So what exactly did she say that misled you?
What she never hints at is how this dinner became what the CIA thought subsequently was the most important moment in Khrushchev's visit to London. And you think, how could a dinner with the opposition party turn into the most important event? The answer is not in what Khrushchev had said about his view of geopolitics. It was the fact that the Labour Party had said, we cannot do a deal with a Russia that does not respect pluralism, that does not respect the right of the Social Democrats, and that Gaitskell, and indeed Bevan and others, had stood up so firmly, and Gaitskell had subsequently said he wouldn't go to Russia. Barbara doesn't really dwell on this, because Barbara and the left very much hopes that this is a moment of breakthrough, a moment when the Iron Curtain might be beginning to rust a bit. And she wants to talk about Khrushchev's idea for, a disarmed zone in the middle of Central Europe. And she and many others on the left thought raising the fate of the Social Democrats, raising the prisoner of conscience issue at all, was actually counterproductive.
So what was it about these recent papers that you re-examined that made you change your view of what actually happened?
Well, two things. When I went back to look at these, and they are wonderful papers because you can almost smell the cigarette smoke and the kind of red drapery and the kind of ghastly heavy meals that they used to have when they were doing business. But when I came to look at them, I actually realised that they don't all date from the same event. And in fact, there are two separate piles of document which Barbara herself had mushed together into one pile and labelled as just this one dinner. I suppose I hadn't wanted to question it because it fed into my idea of Barbara as this woman who was kind of obsessive and focused and motivated to the exclusion of all else. But looking back, there are all sorts of holes in her account of the evening. Why did she have to stay up all night producing a typescript for the New Statesman on Tuesday morning, when one, the whole story was in the Times on Tuesday morning anyway, and two, the New Statesman's print deadline wouldn't have been until Wednesday evening? There was no rush at all. John Freeman was not, in fact, the editor of the paper at that point. He was only an associate editor, but he was probably Barbara's lover. Is this maybe a more significant factor about the all-night session that we don't know about? And certainly there's no evidence either way on that. I merely speculate.
So how was she trying to manipulate her legacy by doing this?
I think it's important to remember that she was writing an autobiography and therefore sorting her papers and so on in the 1980s. At that point, she had been a cabinet minister. She had been in power. She'd actually been, in my view, often a very good and a very brave cabinet minister, but she'd been a member of two, three Wilson governments that were widely viewed as disastrous, and she herself had tarnished her reputation by appearing to swing wildly to the right instead of cleaving to the views of the left. And I think when she came to shape her public memorial in her autobiography, she wanted to re-establish herself as a figure of the left. And therefore, she revisited all her kind of great moments. One of the things you don't want to revisit are the battles in the 1950s, mainly because most people would have said that was what cost Labour successive general election triumphs.
Would it have made a difference to your biography if you'd actually known this at the time?
I think it was just one of those little gem examples that a biographer needs, which demonstrates an essential aspect of your subject's character. Both the fact that she muddled these dinners and the fact that she failed to appreciate or to write about the significance of the dinner, and actually also the events surrounding the dinner, it doesn't cast a particularly good light on Barbara, but it was a very vicious, low civil war that was going on within the party. These were the sort of closing skirmishes, if you like. I think if I'd been able to write it, if I'd realised what I was looking at the time, it would have been important moulding in the portrait of the character that I was trying to write about.
So what has this taught you about the possibility of reconstructing the past?
I think what it really says is that the documents are only the skeleton, the skull, if you like, of the figure you're trying to recreate, and you need to think and reconstruct as imaginatively and as creatively as possible from the basis of the documents. They're no more than a clue.
Journalist and writer Anne Perkins being impressively honest there. My goodness, what a lot of issues she raises, doesn't she? To discuss them with me in the studio is the novelist and essayist Jeff Dyer and The Guardian's chief arts writer Charlotte Higgins, who's currently researching a book about Roman Britain. Jeff, Anne says that documents are no more than the skeleton in a biography. How accurate is this in your experience?
Yeah, I think that's really important because so often with biographies, I find that they're very good. They're saying, oh yeah, on whichever day it was, he had porridge for breakfast, then had some lunch, this kind of stuff. And that's okay in terms of the biography as a diary written out in longhand. It's much more difficult, I think, to give you a sense of somebody becoming who they are, to get that real sense of just how their personality is developing. So to give you an example of this, there's the biography of Diane Arbus by Patricia Bosworth. Now, the Arbus estate really hate this biography. Whereas, and I can't vouch for its factual accuracy or otherwise, but weirdly, I mean, let's suppose it's not entirely reliable on that level of documentary record. I don't think I've ever read a book which gave me such a vivid sense of a person who was born and then evolved into this artist. I mean, you have a real sense of them as a flesh and blood figure, whereas even a very well-received biography, the three volumes of Norman Sherry's Graham Greene. That just seemed a straightforward plod through where Graham Greene went and what he did. But I never felt Graham Greene as a living person. And it's that, I think, that is the real challenge. That's what makes somebody a really great biographer.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were going to write a biography of D.H. Lawrence, weren't you, at one point?
This is the great thing. I never was going to write I was always going to write a mad, crazy book about D.H. Lawrence, but the conceit of the book, the MacGuffin, if you like, was that I had to say I was going to write a straightforward academic book in order to make the descent into the craziness of my actual book, it gave it some sort of momentum, I think.
And that was the result of that was Out of Sheer Rage.
Yes, exactly.
But you still can't keep away from him, can you? Your latest book is a collection of essays, Working the Room, and you've got two of the essays are about Lawrence, so you're still ploughing that old furrow.
I certainly am. And that's, again, I think, a testament to this weird gravitational pull that Lawrence had. And, you know, there's that lovely bit in Rebecca West when the eulogy she wrote for him, when she realises after he died, actually, that whatever Lawrence wrote about, all he was really doing was talking about the state of his own soul, and at different times of his life, different things, different subjects served as, an excuse to do that.
Now, in one of these, you wrote very interestingly about the nature of relating after an author's death to them and their work. Would you just read it to us? And Charlotte, I would like you to take notes and tell us your response when Jeff has read it.
Yeah, so this is a little bit from my book about Out of Sheer Rage. I think it applies particularly to D.H. Lawrence because of the things I've said, but perhaps it has more general resonance too. As time goes by, we drift away from the great texts, the finished works on which an author's reputation is built, towards the journals, diaries, letters, manuscripts, and jottings. This is not simply because, as an author's stature grows posthumously, the fund of published texts becomes exhausted, and we have to make do with matter that was never intended for publication. It's also because we want to get nearer to the man or woman who wrote these books. A curious reversal takes place. The finished works serve as a prologue to the jottings. The published book becomes a stage to be passed through, a draft, en route to the definitive pleasures of the notes, the fleeting impressions, the sketches, in which it had its origin.
So Charlotte, actually what Jeff's describing is a retreat from the fleshed out person to the skull in Anne Perkins's terms, isn't it?
Yes, and what I find really interesting about Jeff's remarks there is what happens when there aren't journals, jottings, biographical details. And of course, that is the case in the text that I'm primarily interested in as a writer, which is the text of ancient Greece and Rome, where there tends to be absolutely nothing. We know nothing. There are no drafts. There are no contemporary biographies. And what happens in those cases is that one notices an insatiable desire for people to invent these details where no details actually exist. So Sappho is a case in point. You know, hundreds of beautiful, tiny little fragments, just tantalising glimpses into what may or may not have been the nature of her life. You know, often these poems are in the first person. But it doesn't add up to a biography. And yet, the late 19th century, for instance, is absolutely littered with attempts to create a biography for Sappho. So, and these veer wildly from the idea that she was presiding over a sexy lesbian colony to being headmistress of a kind of staid girls' boarding school on the island of Lesbos. In the case of Homer, Homer famously, was there even such a person as Homer? Were there more than one poet? Are there a composite of oral poetry? Who knows? But so I've just been reading Samuel Butler's book, The Authoress of the Odyssey, which is a very sustained argument that the Odyssey was written by a woman. So I think that actually bears out Jeff's argument. In the absence of jottings, we simply create the idea of jottings. We fantasise the past.
Yeah, fantasise, Jeff. So the biographer is partly a fantasist, isn't he, she?
Yeah, or, of course, this is when the fiction writer can really come into his or her own. So, I mean, when I was writing my jazz book, for example, there you've got these people who, weirdly, they weren't Mick Jagger-like superstars and that quite ordinary people would have contact with them. But on the other hand, they were these mythic, legendary people. And there are these, the history of jazz is littered with these apocryphal, legendary episodes. Like, for example, everyone knows that Chet Baker got his teeth knocked out, which is a major setback if you're a trumpet player. And, the most popular version of this is that, he got them knocked out by an angry drug dealer. Nobody exactly knows. So, at that point, if you like, there's the vacuum into which the fiction writer whooshes to, because there's it gives you, as Charlotte was saying, this freedom to do what you want. Of course, the more facts there are, the more restricted your approach is. Just I'm now asking this as a sort of question, really. There are a lot of photographers about whom we know virtually nothing. They exist almost entirely in terms of their photographs. So Atjeh, we know almost nothing about Atjeh. E.J. Belloc, William Gedney. I wonder if anyone can think of, say, modern writers or writers from the 19th century onwards who so successfully burnt their tracks that all we have are the finished books.
And people have tried to cover their tracks, haven't they? But often they usually fail, don't they? There's usually well, the thing is, we don't know about the ones who succeed. Perhaps
What about Pynchon? I mean, Pynchon attempts to hide, but that I suppose is a fetishized stance in itself, isn't it? The sort of the invisibility of Thomas Pynchon is a part of being Thomas Pynchon, is a part of Thomas Pynchon's literary performance, I suppose.
Yeah, and also you can sustain that sort of pristine, only the published stuff while you're still alive. But, it'll be interesting to see what happens when Pynchon dies. And, of course, Salinger, who, managed to erase himself, as thoroughly as anyone could. Since his death, all sorts of stuff has come out. And, of course, now it gets perhaps progressively more difficult to wipe the slate clean.
Mm. Now, let's move on a bit from biography to forensic reconstruction. Charlotte, you're doing a little bit of this, aren't you, for your next book?
Well, what I've been doing, Claire, is travelling around Britain, really, looking at Britain's Roman remains and having a think about them. And this is it's a wonderful thing to do. It's an incredibly evocative activity. One is travelling to extraordinarily beautiful parts of the country and looking at these, 2,000-year-old fragments of a completely different civilization, a civilization that was present in Britain for 400 years. And I suppose what interests me primarily as a writer is actually the impossibility of recovering, the impossibility of reconstruction. And I think what I'm allowing myself to do really is to accept the fact that the past can work on one, but one equally works on the past. And I think there's a tension between those two points and one exists in the middle of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are only, because Roman Britain is so fragmentary in its literary documentation, although not compared with Anglo-Saxon Britain, it's extremely tantalising. In other words, there are these extraordinary moments that seem to, out of the great blur of the past, there are moments that seem to come into very, very pristine focus, such that, for instance, I have with me a letter that one woman wrote to another woman in Vindolanda in the first century AD, and it says, Claudia Severa to her Leopardina greetings. On the 11th of September, sister, for the day of the celebration of my birthday, I give you a warm invitation to make sure that you can come to us to make the day more enjoyable for me by your arrival, if you were present. Give my greetings to your Cerealis. My Ilis and my little son sent him their greetings. I shall expect you, sister. Farewell, sister, my dearest soul, as I hope to prosper. And so forth. It's incredibly sweet, generous, affectionate little moment there between two women. And it's incredibly significant, this letter, because this is the first example of a woman's handwriting preserved from anywhere in the Roman Empire. That little sign-off at the end where she says, farewell, sister, my dearest soul. I mean, actually, I find it astonishingly moving. And so that's when the blur comes into focus. But even then, you know, we have no idea about these people, really. We have no idea about the nature of that letter or what that party might have consisted of or looked like. So it's a very melancholic process, this.
But it is a process that it happens in more recent things as well, doesn't it, Jeff? You've just reviewed People Who Eat Darkness, the story of Lucy Blackman, who disappeared in Japan and was later found murdered and dismembered. You know, it's just as difficult to reconstruct what happened to her, isn't it?
So this is this great book by Richard Lloyd Parry just out now. And you know, Parry spends an awful lot of time investigating this case, writing the book. He has access to the detectives, all this kind of stuff. But at the heart of the book, there is this black hole where no one really knows what's going on in the mind of the murderer, the suspect. All the time, Parry is grappling with that which can't be known or understood. So the book becomes, in a way, it's the opposite of a thoroughly successful police investigation, whereby you amass all the evidence and come to a verdict. It's another voyage to some sort of heart of darkness, I guess.
Some of the evidence is from survivors of her family, isn't it? I mean, so he's going on their journey as well.
Yeah, that's right. There's an enormous amount of circumstantial evidence. And partly his book is about the effect that an awful murder like this has on everyone connected with the case.
So what did this book teach you about how to construct a truth through the narrating of it?
I guess there's a really important conclusion he comes to, which is that he realizes that the key thing perhaps is not about what the unknowable motives of the killer were, but in terms of the effect that this killer has had on the lives of everyone connected with Lucy Blackman, the victim.
You could read Jeff's review of People Who Eat Darkness in The Observer this weekend. Thanks very much for coming in, Charlotte and Jeff. Lindsay Irving caught up with Richard Lloyd Parry when he paid a brief visit to London from his home in Japan for the launch of the book.
Richard Lloyd Parry, the story wound on over nearly a decade and you covered it as a foreign correspondent for The Times. What led you to turn it into a book?
Well, I found very early on, reporting it for a newspaper, that it was a very difficult and frustrating story to treat as news. There were so many strange twists, byways, red herrings along the way, especially during that long period where Lucy Blackman was missing rather than known to have been killed. And a standard news article of 600, 800 words was never enough to explain everything. And I realised, when I talked to people back home and came home, they would often ask about that case, the case of the blonde girl who'd been found buried in the cave. And no one really fully understood it. There were always unexplained aspects to it that they asked about, such as why did it take the police so long to find the body?
Yes.
And why was the trial taking so long? And what was she actually doing as a hostess, a so-called hostess in Tokyo. And I realised and discovered as I was researching and writing the book that it's one of these stories that really can't be told properly in less than 400 pages. There were several elements to it. I mean, it was a crime story, of course, from the beginning, and it was the story about a suspect, this man, Giorgio Barra, who was partially convicted of harming Lucy Blackmon. And that was interesting enough. But what made it really fascinating was the other elements. One was the trial, this extraordinarily protracted process, which taught me a lot about the Japanese justice and police system that I hadn't realised before. And the other thing was the family, Lucy Blackmon's family. And I hadn't expected when I began the research that they would be such a big part of the story. But people will remember that after several years, when the trial was quite advanced, Tim Blackmon, Lucy's father, accepted nearly £500,000 from Giorgio Barra, the suspect, and attracted a lot of criticism, opprobrium, really, for that.
You might expect a book like of this kind, or a book that's about a true crime, to get inside the mind of a killer, as it were. But you're very careful to stand back from gaining such apparent insights and be wary of what you've found.
Yes, I suppose when I started out, I saw Giorgio Barra as a mystery that I would try to solve, you know, almost like a puzzle box which I would open and find a secret inside. And I spent a lot of time in Osaka, which is where he grew up and lived for a while, trying to find out more about him and his background and his family and their background. And it was extraordinarily difficult, not only for me. I mean, I talked to a number of Japanese tabloid journalists, effectively, you know, who are as determined and hard-nosed as tabloid reporters anywhere. And they all told me that they also had found it really almost impossible to find out about his background. Both him and his family seemed to go through their lives erasing traces of themselves from it. There are almost no photographs of him, for example. He refused to be photographed. The only photographs are from him when he was in his early 20s. I realised that I hadn't got into his head, and I began to wonder then whether there was even a mystery to crack. I mean, Giorgio Barra, during this whole legal process, there was never any psychiatric evaluation of him. That doesn't often happen in Japan. And I didn't want to, you know, play the amateur psychologist. But clearly, you know, his modus operandi, these serial rapes of drugged women, indicates a very unusual psychology. I don't know whether he's the kind of person you can classify as a psychopath or not. I wouldn't use that word. But in reading around the subject about people who are labelled psychopaths, one of the things that's often said about them is that they're actually extremely uninteresting personalities. One of the things that marks them is really a lack of connections with other people. And in looking into Giorgio Barra, one of the things that was striking was I spoke to a number of people who knew him in his earlier life, and not one of them unequivocally would describe themselves as a friend. I didn't find a single friend of Giorgio Barra, and one of his lawyers once said to me that he was a man without friends. And I began to wonder if that was the secret, that rather than a kind of positive destructiveness, which could be explained by something in his psychology and his past, he was simply an absence of humanity.
Writing a book like this is a perilous business, both in order to avoid sensationalism and also to respect the feelings of the numerous people still living whose lives have been hollowed out by it. I think you've pulled off the balancing act, but how much of a worry was it for you, and how did you sort of organise the book around that?
Very early on, I went to Lucy Blackmon's immediate family, her parents, her brother and her sister, and told them that I wanted to do this book and was going to do it, and asked for their cooperation, and all of them cooperated and generously gave their time and talked to me at length about things that were personally very, very painful to them. But there was a certain sensitivity because of the relationship between Lucy Blackmon's father and mother, Tim and Jane, who were bitterly divorced before Lucy even went to Japan. And far from bringing them together, the tragedy of her disappearance and death wrote in even deeper the bitterness between them. I had to negotiate that, and you know, I made it clear to both of them that I wasn't taking sides. I wasn't there to adjudicate their differences. I was there to record a story about their daughter.
And in terms of the way you've reported it, in a way that probably a newspaper report, certainly a newspaper report, would not have allowed you, you've allowed their two experiences of the aftermath of the crime not to match up in the book. You've made room for that.
Yes, I mean, they don't match up. They had different perceptions of what happened. Early on, I talked to Jane Blackman, now called Jane Steer. She's remarried, and her husband, her new husband. And I had dinner with them and talked to them about my plans for this book. And Jane's husband, Roger, said to me, we do want to help you with this book, and we want it to be a good book. But there's something you must understand. There are two versions of this story. There's the story that Tim Blackmer will tell you, and then there's the truth, which Jane will tell you. I mean, I respect their conviction about what happened, but as a writer, of course, I can't simply accept that there's one version of the truth. But rather than trying to constantly play the referee about things which I can't know the truth of, I thought it more interesting in a way to leave those versions in parallel and let readers judge for themselves.
This book took almost 5 years of very careful research for you, and that led you to very different accounts of the truth we saw from both Tim's parents and elsewhere. How close at the end of it do you feel you've got to the truth? How far is it possible? How close to the truth is it possible to get in a journalistic non-fiction account?
You know, there are still questions, but the case is finished now. I mean, literally 2 days before this book was due to go into production, the Supreme Court rejected the final appeal, which means the sentence on him, the life sentence, is final. And in some ways, that's satisfying to have the full story.
And the book has, the case is finished, but as the book explains very clearly, it's never going to finish for the family. It's not something they're going to be able to get past. Has writing the book brought you to any kind of sort of resolution or dread word closure?
It was a case that really got under one's skin, and I think I wasn't the only reporter who found that. Others who reported at the time would agree, I think, that it was a very fascinating and disturbing case. Almost got into your dreams, you know, especially during that period when Lucy Blackmore was missing. So it is satisfying to nail this down and to see legal process finally being completed and Georgie O'Barra going to prison for a long time.
Lindsay Irving there talking to Richard Lloyd Parry. And that's all from us for this week. Join us next week to hear all about the fun of World Book Day and for news about the launch of The Guardian's very own children-only website. Meanwhile, in The Guardian's Saturday Review, John Mullen chooses the 12 rising stars of British fiction. On Sunday, The Observer's new review will be canvassing opinion from far and wide about a new book by the teacher who became the darling of the Tory party conference with her damning views on state schooling. She's Catherine Burbleson. Plus, of course, there'll be Jeff Dyer's review of People Who Eat Darkness. Until next week, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Lucy Greenwell, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.